This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour, our last episode of 2016, which was quite a remarkable year on a number of fronts. If you haven't had the chance to do so, I'd like to encourage you to go back and listen to our program from this past Wednesday, where we took a look at 2016 in review. We had quite a rousing discussion about the most important events of this past year. Well, we're back today to talk about the week. Our panel of trumpet writers is eager and ready to look back on the important events of quite a momentous week, the last week of 2016. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be here.
We have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me on the show.
America's shameful ambush of Israel at the UN. That's the cover story of this week's Trumpet Weekly, the biggest event of this past week in our report of the significant news from around the world over the past 7 days. President Barack Obama has had a terrible record of his treatment of the Jewish state of Israel during his 8 years in office. That's a major theme in one chapter of Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury's new booklet, Great Again, which we'd be happy to give you a free copy of if you ask for it. We've speculated about just what President Obama might do in his final months in office to hurt Israel, and this past week he confirmed that speculation in a big way. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
So this was actually last Friday, but the hoopla surrounding it this week just really continues to be very important in the news, especially here in Israel. The Israelis have not got over what the United States did by not vetoing a anti-Israel resolution at the United Nations Security Council. This resolution differs from a lot of past resolutions against Israel because it specifically states that the territories of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, Israel has absolutely no right to them, no legal validity to be living in those areas, and any of their settlements or just places where Jews live inside the East Jerusalem and the West Bank. They are there illegally. They are occupiers. They need to get out. And normally, you know, the United States, there was a similar resolution back in 2011 or 12, and President Obama did decide to veto that one. And if one of those Security Council members, the permanent members, vetoes a resolution, it does not pass. And yet this time he decided to let it go right through. So this is international consensus now that the West Bank, East Jerusalem, including in that, doesn't belong to Israel. It's not up for negotiation, which was the previous what was the previous belief that this would have been up for negotiation in a final peace deal with the Palestinians?
Now, there's obviously a lot here, and you did a full Trumpet Daily program earlier in the week on this subject. But just to try to give us the Reader's Digest version of it, how binding is this? Well, first of all, let's talk about just how radical of a departure from previous American policy this is, and how the ramifications of this from Israel's perspective, what this means going forward for them.
Right. So this, I mean, previous American administrations going back for probably till Jimmy Carter in the 1980s, he had a similar resolution that they let pass, but that was before Oslo, before the Camp David Accords, before all this other American influence in trying to mediate the peace negotiation between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So for the past 20 years, there's been the general consensus has been from the United States that we have three areas of negotiations with the Palestinians and the Jews. The first being the West Bank. Is the West Bank going to go back to the Palestinians? Are we going to have some land swaps to ensure that a lot of Jews that are living in the West Bank can be in the new Israeli territory? There was that one. And then they were going to try and deal with the right of return, all the Palestinian refugees that had to flee Israel back in 1948, whether they come back or not. But the other area was a totally separate area, was what to do with Jerusalem, because the Jews have always said that they're never going to divide the city. So it must be, you know, we'll work something out, whether it's an international city, whether the Jews are in control or international people are in control. It was going to be negotiated completely separately. This does away with the entire rationale between of the American mediating standpoint for the past 20 years. Oslo is no longer in effect. There is no reason for the Palestinians to negotiate with Israel anymore, because or no reason to do land for peace. I mean, that was the basis, right? Israel will give them land that is currently Israeli. I will give you our land if you can say that you would want to live by a Jewish state and you will stop your terrorism and stop fighting against us, we'll give you that land. There's no reason for them to stop fighting anymore, because the world says, and the United States did not kick up a fuss about, they let it pass, that East Jerusalem and the West Bank right now belongs to the Palestinians, not Israel at all. This is a huge departure from any other resolution over the past 30 or 40 years.
That's phenomenal, essentially legitimizing the intifada and all of the violence that the Palestinians have perpetrated over the past couple of decades here in spite of the peace process, also legitimizing those who have, even since this was passed, you have Palestinians saying, well, we're still never going to recognize the existence of the State of Israel. So to think that this would actually improve the chances of coexistence, peaceful coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians is truly remarkable. And it would be maybe easy for someone unfamiliar with the situation to say, well, the United States, all they did was abstain, not a big deal. But essentially, the U.S. has been the only factor preventing a resolution like this from being passed before this.
Right. Well, you've only got so many permanent members of the Security Council that are there, and the only one that's been traditionally friendly towards Israel has been the United States, and they have stopped it time and again at the UN for trying to have a resolution like this, because it's absolutely absurd, really, that you would think of East Jerusalem. And when I say East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, people naturally think there's a divider. Yeah, there's a fence up, or there's a wall that Israel has built through part of East Jerusalem to stop terrorists from coming in, but that's only been there from 2002. I mean, since 1967, when Israel conquered East Jerusalem, took it from Jordan, who was occupying it at the time, in a defensive war, they took this, which we won't get into the legal validity of Israel having that. You've had Jews living side by side with Palestinians for 30, 40 years in East Jerusalem. Natural growth of a city takes place. Israeli law doesn't say, you know, Jews can't, you know, it doesn't discriminate between Jews and Arabs. An Arab can buy in West Jerusalem just like a Jew can buy in East Jerusalem. Yeah. Yet right now, if you're a Jew in East Jerusalem, I'm sorry, you're an illegal occupier. And it is absurd when you think of East Jerusalem. That includes the old city. That includes where the Wailing Wall is. So now if a Jew wants to go and pray at the Wailing Wall, apparently he is stepping on Palestinian territory from the United States standpoint and from the world standpoint. Now, the big question is, how binding is it? Is this something
That was my next question, Brent.
Sorry. Well, that's what really it frustrates me about people not thinking this is a big deal, because they believe when Mr. Trump gets into the Oval Office that he can, you can't do away with a resolution. Once a resolution passes at the UN, then you've got to get all the permanent members again to agree with changing it. And you're good luck getting Russia, China together to vote for the Israelis. It's not going to happen. So, okay, who cares about the UN then? That Mr. Trump gets in, he's going to force people and bend them over backwards. Well, I don't know if he can do that, because what you've got is international consensus now that Israel is an occupier in those territories. I listened to an interview with on CNN with Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, talked to a CNN news anchor, and he was saying, how many countries right now agree that Israel has right to East Jerusalem? How many countries? You say that, you know, it's okay for Israel to live there. Well, who agrees with you? And he could say no one. No one agrees with Israel and that they have right to East Jerusalem, because it was only the United States that was standing up for these past decades for them.
Truly a remarkable development. It puts Israel in a very, very difficult position going forward. And we've talked quite a bit about just what is Israel going to do as they're backed into a corner, as they run out of options, as they run out of allies. And biblical prophecy definitely has a strong indication of just how desperate they're going to get. And we would expect that that would really greatly accelerate the timetable of the fulfillment of those prophecies. Well, thank you for that, Brent. The United Kingdom's National Archives released some previously secret documents about the period around 1989, 1990. And as longtime trumpet readers know, these were crucial years for Germany. This was the time that the Berlin Wall fell, Germany reunited. And these new papers show that Britain was very worried about Germany's history and how this new united Germany would behave. Stephen Fleury talked about this on his Trumpet Daily radio show this morning. We're going to hear more about it as we go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, these documents specifically relate to then Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and exactly her thoughts on the reunification of Germany. Now, we did have some previous, you know, some of you may be thinking, okay, this sounds familiar. We did have some previous declassified thoughts from Margaret Thatcher on reunification of Germany a year or two ago. So it was something we wrote on back then. But this is more documentation now going into further detail. And I think it's just fascinating that, you know, sometimes at the Trumpet it can feel a bit lonely, warning about Germany, warning about, you know, look at Germany's history. There are good reasons that Britain, that America should be wary of what Germany could develop into. And this is just proof that actually a lot of people held these fears. Well, not a lot, but at the highest level, some people held these fears. And my favorite piece of information from these records that were released is that Margaret Thatcher, in March 1989, she convened a secret meeting of historians. And I love this idea of a top secret meeting of historians. But they came to her official residence and they talked about Germany. And she was that concerned, and she turned to history. And back throughout the 90s, time and again, we would quote Margaret Thatcher on Germany, because she was just about the best in terms of modern contemporary politicians and warning about what Germany could become at the heart of Europe. And you get an idea looking at these papers of why she thought that way. And it's because she turned to these historians. She got a tried to get a long view here. Some of the minutes of the meeting, they show that some historians expressed concerns that the countries had not gotten over its Nazi past. It said apprehension about Germany did not just relate to the Nazi period, but to the whole post-Bismarckian era, and inevitably caused deep distrust. The questions posed at the meeting were things like, who are the Germans? Have the Germans changed? What will be the consequences of reunification? It said that some at the seminar asked how a cultural and cultivated nation had allowed itself to be brainwashed into barbarism. If it happened once, could it not happen again? So I think these are just fascinating questions, but these are exactly the same type of questions we've been discussing at the Trumpet. And so it's just very interesting to see these same discussions going on secretly at the highest level of British politics.
Yeah, there are a lot of reasons to like and to appreciate Margaret Thatcher. Here's one more to add to the list, the secret meeting of historians. I suppose it depends on the quality of the historians, what the quality of the information you get out of a meeting like that. But in this case, how wise and how pragmatic it is to convene that kind of a meeting in order to really get a handle on what they were dealing with there.
Right, that's right. And I think it does... it shows a lot of judgment from Margaret Thatcher as a statesman. Another completely unrelated thing that we find out from these questions is just how distraught the rest of the world, and surprised the rest of the world was when Margaret Thatcher resigned. And one of them, it sounds like even Henry Kissinger was crying on the phone when he heard the news. But you get the fact that she turns to historians for a question like this, I think shows where she got a lot of that wisdom from.
So can you give us a sense of more of, say, what came out of that, what it was that appears in these papers that Margaret Thatcher was so concerned about? You were talking about the never getting over the Bismarckian history. Is there anything else, any other revelations that you can share with us?
Right. The history was a large part of it. But then here's some more quotes from the same kind of papers. It said, the way in which the Germans currently use their elbows and threw their weight around in the European community suggested that a lot still had not changed. And that was back in 1989, 1990, and they were concerned about how Germany was throwing its weight around the European community. This was before Germany really pushed Europe to go to war in Yugoslavia and NATO to go to war in Yugoslavia, well before even things like the financial crisis. And so I think even that, you know, a lot of people have said, okay, it's not happening exactly the way or as quickly as, say, Margaret Thatcher thought things might happen. But it certainly shows things have been developing and, you know, Germany has been becoming more and more, even just more and more assertive since they had those meetings. And I just another quote that I thought was just excellent. In sum, no one had serious misgivings about the present leaders or political elite of Germany. But what about 10, 15 or 20 years from now? Could some of the unhappy characteristics of the past reemerge with just as destructive consequences? A minute from a meeting with the prime minister that could have come from a Trumpet article.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd have to think that had they been able to see a lot of the headlines that we've seen since Germany reunified, that they wouldn't have been terribly surprised to see where we are today. They wouldn't have been terribly surprised by the war in Kosovo, what happened in Yugoslavia, and how this step-by-step has reached the point where Germany has such economic control, where they're driving military unification, where they're really so much at the heart of what's happening in Europe. That's exactly what they were concerned would happen.
It is. I think it's just happened. I mean, the Germans are clever about it. It's happened more gradually. And I think a lot of the German public didn't necessarily want to take on this big aggressive role. But because it's happened gradually, it's happened without so much fanfare. It seems like a lot of people have now gone to sleep to the point that now these concerns are released 30 years later. And it's just kind of a case of, ha, 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 look at how worried they were about Germany, even as Germany is just reaching unprecedented heights of power. But because it just didn't happen as quickly and as blatantly as some of those thought it could, just in the immediate aftermath of German reunification, everyone's just now gone to sleep about those claims.
Yeah, excellent observations. We appreciate that, Richard. You are listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. In China, there are some of the elites among the Chinese leadership who are concerned that the president of that country could take a page out of Vladimir Putin's playbook and change the Communist Party rules in order to extend his grip on power. And for this, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, in the past, we've heard Westerners sometimes compare the Chinese president Xi Jinping to Vladimir Putin because of his strongman tendencies and his nationalistic and even authoritarian approach to leadership. But now Mr. Xi is making the headlines because even there in China, among the Chinese elite, even including some of the leading officials in the Chinese Communist Party, which Mr. Xi is head of, they are fearing the same thing. Some of these elites say that there are troubling signs emerging that basically show that Mr. Xi is laying the groundwork right now to be able to stay in power after his second term expires, which would mean ignoring the constitutional limits there. There's a Wall Street Journal article that was written on December 26th, and it does a really good job of just showing what's happening in this situation, why there's so much concern about Xi's abuse of power among many in the Chinese leadership there. And we've talked on a previous episode, I think, about the way Mr. Xi has taken personal charge of China's economy and also its armed forces and most of the other levers of power there. And in doing this, he's really overturned a collective leadership system that was introduced back in the 70s, just after the death of Mao Zedong. That system was designed to protect against one-man rule. But Mr. Xi has won a lot of popular support by fighting corruption in China and by mobilizing the Chinese military to enforce territorial claims outside of China. And he's been able to harness the power of all of that support to really make himself not just president, but also party chief, military commander, and more. He actually now has 12 official titles. So that ban on, or the system that created collective leadership is totally gone now. He has 12 of the most important titles in the country. And so that consolidation of power has been happening for quite some time, and it is an alarming trend. But now, added to all of that, evidence is emerging that as Mr. Xi nears the end of his first five-year term, he's attempting to block the promotion of a potential successor next year. So analysts say that this is a sure sign that basically just shows that after his second term expires in 2022, he will attempt to stay in power. By blocking a potential successor from rising now, he can just sort of keep that from happening. There's one leading Communist Party official who said Mr. Xi wants to keep on going after 2022. He wants to explore a leadership structure just like the Putin model. And listeners may remember that after Vladimir Putin reached the end of the two terms that his constitution allowed back in 2008, he installed basically a puppet for 4 years, Dmitry Medvedev, and then Putin later had the constitution changed in order to allow himself to be able to basically be president for a long, long time, potentially until 2026, I think it is. But even at that time, he could easily make an alteration to stay in longer. So that's the kind of thing that this Communist Party official is saying when he talks about the Putin model of leadership. And then several other high-ranking Chinese officials with access to the highest-ranking party leaders say similar things about Mr. Xi. They say the evidence is clear that China is shifting toward a rigid form of autocracy. And there's even talk within the party of shrinking and downgrading or altogether scrapping the Politburo Standing Committee, which is China's top leadership body. In many ways, it governs the president's power. There's talk of scrapping that and adopting a more presidential system like Russia's. And there's one pretty sobering quote in this Wall Street Journal article. It's a statement by Huang Jing, who is an expert on Chinese politics at the University of Singapore. He says, Xi's dilemma is that he can't get things done without power. He feels the need to centralize, but then he risks undermining these institutions designed to prevent a very powerful leader becoming a dictator. And then there's one more quote from a retired senior official. He said, Mao built the nation. Dao Xiaoping made it rich. We're now in the Xi era, which will make it strong. So we've talked about the rise of strongmen on the global scene in the past and just sort of a resurgence of authoritarianism that's happening globally. And it's all making world war more likely to have more of these men who just have unchecked power. And now it's really trending that way quickly in one of the world's most powerful and most aggressive nations, China.
Yeah, it does, first of all, just thinking about this, just how it makes you realize just how unique the Anglo-American age has been, where we've had such effective checks on this type of thing from happening, because this really is more consistent, it seems, with what's happened historically in nations all over the world, that most people have lived under some form of authoritarianism, some kind of varying degrees of say benevolence or malevolence on the part of that ruler, but certainly a lot of power concentrated in the hands of a single individual, like we see is happening in China right now. I'm just wondering how much does this fit with a historical pattern in China, or is this more of an anomaly?
Well, I think there are parallels in recent history, mostly with Mao Zedong, Chairman Mao. He had unbelievable power, unchecked by anyone, and he thought that he would be able to use it to achieve the one true communism in China. He thought that he'd be able to usher in a beautiful utopia. he ended up killing some 60 million people with his just really backward policies, and his, you know, the lack of checks and balances allowed him to do all sorts of things that even a modest panel of advisors would have helped him avoid a lot of the famine and things like that that resulted from his policies. But he refused a lot of advice, and so he ended up killing, I believe most historians say, more people than any other person on Earth. So to see Xi Jinping, you know, taking on powers that we saw not even 50 years ago result in that kind of cataclysmic suffering, I think it is an alarming trend.
And it is interesting to see the alignment between what's happening in China and Russia. We've talked so much about just how those two powers are prophesied to come together to unite and to kind of form a major alliance that's going to play a huge role in events in the future, and to have each of them. We've talked about, we've kind of tracked this as we've seen Mr. Xi's rise, similar parallel type situations happening politically in both countries.
Yeah, I was going to say as well that as sad as it may be that these last two or three decades in China under one party communist rule might be some of the most freedom the Chinese people have had in their history. I mean, for like 4,000 years, we've been ruled by a dynasty of, or various dynasties of god emperors, and then that transitioned into your like a nationalist government under the World War II era, and then into Mao Zedong, who's this communist dictator, and then after, of course, his Cultural Revolution, he was so brutal that they changed their constitution to allow that, like, well, how about we not be ruled by one man, how about we ruled by like a panel of 8 to 9 men. And it looks like they're getting away from that now, probably more towards what China's been historically used to. But right, kind of this idea that we're going to have 9 people running the country instead of just one is something that's really only happened for China for a handful of decades out of its 4,000-year history.
Well, thanks for that story, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. In the United States, there have been a lot of accusations against Russia for hacking the presidential election. Well, in a sense, some of these concerns were given legitimacy this past week when President Barack Obama put sanctions against top Russian government intelligence officials. He announced the expulsion of Russian diplomats from the United States in response to Russia's alleged use of cyber attacks to interfere with the election. To learn more about this, we're going to turn to Andrew.
Right. Well, probably most of our listeners will remember from last summer when someone hacked into a Democratic National headquarters and found a lot of emails kind of exposing some of Hillary Clinton's campaign's underhanded techniques against Bernie Sanders. And so now there was some concern that a lot of these Bernie Sanders voters, who are just really offended at how poorly he was treated, didn't vote this year, and that may have helped Donald Trump get elected. And so it's been increasingly put out there that Russia was the one who did the Democratic hacked the Democratic headquarters, and apparently now the CIA has agreed with it, that they think Russia's the one who's done it, and now President Obama's also agreed with that. Until yesterday, it really culminated with him putting sanctions against Russian intelligence officials and telling 35 Russian diplomats that they had 72 hours to get out of the country. Now, as far as how this is going to affect Russia's economy, probably all that much. Like I said, these sanctions are against a fairly small group of people who are intelligence officials. They're not really business people we were doing much trade with anyway. But it is just really symbolic on the part of the Obama administration as to whether we've proved conclusively that Russia's did that hack or not. It is, I think George Friedman had written this a couple months ago, but even before the revelation, that when they were first looking into doing this, that it would be kind of a way to delegitimize the election. Mm-hmm. Especially people who just read over it briefly, see the headline like, oh, Russia's sanctioned because they hacked the election.
Right.
That really just makes it sound like, oh, wow, this election wasn't legitimate. And there aren't, I mean, the votes were the votes. They right. definitely won the Electoral College. Now,
well, this isn't even suggesting that those emails were weren't actually there, right? I mean, this is just saying that, well, Russia publicized this internal dialogue within the Democratic Party that did happen.
Right. That would just definitely the claim is that there was actually, obviously, everyone knows there was tension between the Hillary Clinton campaign and the Bernie Sanders campaign. And
some of those damning revelations, the fact that they suppressed voter turnout just because they revealed just how underhanded the Democratic Party was being. I mean, I guess in some ways your sin will find you out.
Right, definitely in some ways. And then on the other side, too, it's definitely not unrealistic that Russia would have wanted to have done something like that. We've talked on this program a little bit before already over how Putin's hoping for a reset with the new president. So if he can get kind of like a new party in power and a brand new start, that he may be able to get some of these sanctions lifted. So there is good evidence that the Russians definitely wanted Donald Trump to win this election, in hopes at least that he would be lift some of the sanctions that are in place over his invasion of Ukraine. And then, so it's definitely possible they could have done this. There is still quite a bit of debate whether they did the hack or not, but said by officially sanctioning it, it is kind of a way for Obama to delegitimize the election without having much economic consequence, which has really been, like I said, a hallmark of these last month or so. He's only got three more weeks in office, but between these sanctions on Russia and he does like a new executive order banning oil drilling in Alaska, he's had like dozens of executive orders on other environmental laws, and then the UN resolution against Israel. It's just kind of making the transition to the next president as difficult as possible, and going to be making his the next president's, like I said, life as difficult as possible. That first time's in office, trying to get over some of these last minute things he's done just as he's moved out the door.
Yeah, he's not going gently into that that good night of the inauguration of the next president. Did you have any comment looking at this from the standpoint of, say, Russia's relationship with the United States? Or
well, I think that maybe about 12 or 16 hours ago, the foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, he said, we need to follow suit. We need to expel 35 American diplomats from Russia. And the headlines were that's going to happen. But then maybe 2 or 3 hours ago, President Putin came out and said, no, we're not going to expel them. We're going to wait for Donald Trump to come into office. And I think that things are going to get a lot more peaceful between Russia and the U.S. at that time. So to me, that was a fairly big development in the story, because it shows that we really could see a pretty massive thaw between, at least Putin is expecting a pretty massive thaw. Normally, he would love to jump on board this tit-for-tat kind of retaliation against the U.S., but he wants to keep things from escalating. And it's going to be an interesting year with Trump in office and with, you know, Mr. Putin really looking to him to possibly lift those sanctions.
Thanks for that, gentlemen. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about what the battle for the Iraqi city of Mosul says about Iran, how the Catholic Church response to the migrant crisis looks like it is changing, Japan's prime minister visiting Pearl Harbor, and how big city mayors in the United States are uniting against one Donald J. Trump. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Last week, we talked about the amazing development that Iraq has incorporated a huge Iranian-sponsored Shiite militia into its official security forces. Iran's influence in Iraq has steadily increased ever since Saddam Hussein was removed back in 2003. The fulfillment of a dramatic prophecy, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief has drawn attention to repeatedly. A battle over the Iraqi city of Mosul shows further evidence of that Iranian influence. And for this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So for about 9 weeks, the Iraqi city of Mosul has been under attack. Currently, Islamic State is who's in control of that city, and about 25% of the city has been taken. So they've still got 75% to go. But it looks like, you know, it's just a matter of time. The prime minister of Iraq, Abadi, he says that Mr. Abadi says it's going to be another 3 months of fighting there in northern Iraq against the Islamic State. And once this city falls, that means the Islamic State is gone entirely from Iraq. And yet, as you mentioned in the introduction, we have this Shiite militia, about 100,000 men. So this is quite the fighting force that answers to Iran that's been incorporated into the Iraqi military that is taking part in this mission to liberate Mosul. While they're not going all the way into the city, they are on the outskirts, and they're ensuring the western part of the city that no Islamic State fighters go back to Syria and stop them off. But what is interesting, and what Yaroslav Trofimov writes for the Wall Street Journal this week, is what happens next? What happens once Mosul is completely cleared from the Islamic State? What are these Shiite militias going to do? You've got 100,000 men answering to Iran, part of Iraq's army in northern Iraq. What do they do after that point? And he says that from a number of sources that he has, even the popular mobilization forces themselves, the Shiite militia, they say that they're going to go across the border and help Assad out.
Mm. So this is exactly what we were talking about last week, just how much essentially Iran is using this force to kind of treat Iraq's frontier as an Iranian frontier and using that as a means of bolstering their presence and their control over the situation in Syria. So here's a man who's looking at the situation and saying, essentially, this is easily what we could expect to see happen here in the next couple of months.
Yeah, definitely. And this, I mean, he's not going out in too much of a limb by saying it, since they are stating it themselves that they've even got some approval from Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to cross the border, these Shiites, and to support him. Because we know that Iran's goal is to create this big thoroughfare across the northern Middle East from their own border, across Iraq, into Syria, into Lebanon, so they can access the Mediterranean Sea, supply their proxy forces. And you do have this gap right now that is still occupied by the Islamic State in western Syria. So they're not done. Iran is not done. If they're going to complete this thoroughfare, they need to ensure that the Islamic State is finally routed out of western Syria, and it looks like they're going to use their fighters to do that, to cross the border. Why this is dramatic is because you've got, you know, a foreign power that is crossing borders with an army without hesitation,
right?
It seems. And I mean, the world is just watching this as it happens and seems to be, I don't know if they're surprised by it. I don't think anyone's surprised by it anymore. They're kind of accepting that this is going to happen.
You kind of allude to this in the way that you put the piece together for the Trumpet Weekly, that this has to be something that Europe is watching pretty closely. This Wall Street Journal writer is noting just how much influence Iran has gained in this region, and how much is this going to extend into Syria. There's got to be a lot of other people, including European leaders, who are watching this, who have been tracking Iran's rise and their spread of influence throughout the region, and with some concern. This has to be adding to that, surely.
I'm sure it would. If you go back to the migrant crisis, the whole reason we have that, it's good to remember, is that the Syrian president was killing his own people, and they had to flee, a lot of them. But the only reason that he was able to do that was because Iran supplied him with a lot of extra fighters. So if Europe's viewing this, they're not viewing this in a positive light, that Iran is expanding its own empire. And other people, I think, another country that isn't probably viewing this in a positive light is probably Russia, since this week, on Thursday, they look like they've got a peace deal worked out with Turkey, inside Syria that has held for a day, and like we'll probably see more of where, how it's going to go in the next couple of weeks. But the other story in the Trumpet Weekly is about how Iran is the greatest threat to that peace deal because they want to keep on gobbling up territory inside Syria. So, I mean, Russia might not be happy about Iran's moves and Europe might not be happy, but you can be sure that they are definitely watching Iran move across the Middle East.
Thank you for that, Brent. That leads to our next story. The migrant crisis has been a frequent subject on the Trumpet Hour this past year. And one thing that's come up as we talk about this is the Catholic Church's response. So far, the Church has basically told European countries they should welcome in more migrants, and the Pope has really been kind of at the head of that encouragement. But now, one of the Church's most senior leaders is saying this is a mistake. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
That's right. Cardinal Christopher Schönborn, he's the Archbishop of Vienna, he gave an interview on Austrian television where he basically kind of said, oops, sorry, we made a mistake about this whole migration thing. So he said, sure, in the beginning, I also said with Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, we can do it. And many important experts in Austria said, we can do it. And then he went on to say, we then realized that there is another dimension and we need common European plans. We need more help in the ground. In the meantime, I believe this is clear. We cannot accommodate all refugees. We must first see that they can find and live in their homeland again. So a significant shift there. And he even admitting that the Catholic Church's position at the start there, saying we can do it, we need to bring more of these migrants in, was wrong.
So we have a story about this Austrian cardinal. We can't accommodate all refugees. It was written by the man sitting right in front of me, Andrew Miller. How big of a development is this, Andrew? How big of a shift is this? Because we've been talking about just in some ways how unusual the Pope's position on this subject has been, how at odds with general European sentiment, the way that it's developing as these problems have been increasing with migrants. This seems to be much more in line with what we would expect to come from the Vatican.
Right. Well, the Catholic Church has been kind of grappling with this issue is that officially it's normally a very pro-immigration institution. I think we've got an article in this latest Trumpet about the immigration crisis in America and the Pope saying that he's like, I'm the head of a universal church, which mm-hmm. considers itself the mothers of all people. Therefore, I really like immigration and we shouldn't be drawing lines and we shouldn't be drawing borders. But and then on the obviously going back further in history, there's also a big push in the Catholic Church that they need to defend Europe against Islam. So they've really been able kind of grappling on how to do that. And so Christoph Schönborn, this is kind of a new position for them, which has kind of allowed him to kind of keep both positions, still being friendly towards migrants, but also realizing that we need to take care of these people, but we need to take care of these people in a way that keeps them in their own homeland, meaning that basically saying we need common European solutions to support and stabilize Africa and the Middle East so that these people can live there and our people can live here. So it is definitely more in line with some of the things that Pope Benedict has said in the past, which makes sense because Schönborn was a student of Benedict's. Mm-hmm. And it is quite senior in the church, student of Benedict's. Even Pope Francis has been relying on him quite a bit as kind of like his like mediator with the more conservative wing of the church. He does a really good job at interpreting Francis's statements in a way that kind of mediates between the more maybe conservatives and liberal wings of the Catholic Church that promotes unity. And for some of those reasons, there are a lot of Vatican watchers speculating he could even be possibly the next pope. He's one of the probably top 10 names you hear floated most often for a possible successor if Francis were to die or retire.
Well, it is definitely something that we would expect to increase the Vatican dealing with the migrant crisis in a way that would be much more in line with expecting to see some sort of a conflict between the Catholic Church with Catholic Europe and the Middle East. And so we'll certainly watch for that. If that man became Pope, I'm sure that that would increase the likelihood of that significantly. Well, we appreciate that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. The most shocking, provocative act against the United States in World War II was Japan's surprise attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, killing over 2,400 Americans. Until 9/11, the worst foreign attack on U.S. soil in the nation's history. It was the act that finally provoked America to join the war. Well, in a historic first, Japan's prime minister came and visited the site of that attack this past week. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the Japanese prime minister, Shinzo Abe, he made a historic visit for the first time for an acting prime minister to Pearl Harbor there. That was on the 27th of December. And while he was there, he expressed his, quote, sincere and everlasting condolences for the more than 2,400 Americans and the 64 Japanese that were killed during that Japanese sneak attack back in 1941. Mr. Abe also said, "We must never repeat the horrors of war again. This is the solemn vow the people of Japan have taken." So a lot of analysts and pundits are really celebrating Abe's visit. They're declaring it a victory for diplomacy and for the Japan-U.S. alliance. But it's important to note that Mr. Abe's statement was not an actual apology. An apology would have been saying, "I'm sorry that our imperial government killed those people in that sneak attack." But instead, Abe basically said, "I'm sorry that these people, both the Americans and the Japanese, died." You know, his failure to ascribe the blame to Japan really hollowed the statement of the key ingredient of an apology, accepting the blame. And really, this was to be expected. No one really expected Mr. Abe to come out and offer a true apology. But his carefully chosen words allowed him to accomplish two things simultaneously. It let him demonstrate to the increasingly belligerent China that the U.S.-Japan alliance remains robust, and it also let him avoid upsetting the hawkish factions of Japanese society who believe that Japan has nothing to apologize for with Pearl Harbor or any other aspect of World War II. And that's really significant. It shows that the dangerous and dark spirit of fanatic militarism does remain alive and well among some in the Japanese leadership. One example to demonstrate this is from Hiromichi Moteki. He's the acting chairman for Japan's Society for the Dissemination of Historical Fact. After Abe's statements, Mr. Moteki said he was, quote, relieved that Abe did not apologize. Then he said, "Why should Abe apologize? For the prime minister to apologize would be a distortion of history, because Japan's view of history is still strongly influenced by the outcome of the Tokyo war trials, that Japan was the aggressor and in the wrong." So that's just egregious historical revisionism. He's saying Japan was not the aggressor. We were not in the wrong. And there are many Japanese, like Mr. Moteki, who insist that the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was not a sneak attack. They insist that China instigated the Sino-Japanese War. They deny the Nanking Massacre. They deny that the Japanese Imperial Army used comfort women during the war.
These are all well-established historical facts.
Well-established facts. And these Japanese conservatives basically just deny all of them. They deny any Japanese wrongdoing in the lead-up to and during World War II. And so I just think that Mr. Abe's reluctance to confront such dangerous historical revisionists, it really just exposes the worrying underpinnings of his leadership. There's evidence that Mr. Abe himself shares in a lot of these dangerous revisionist beliefs. And it's sobering because it shows that the spirit of Japanese militarism does remain alive and well in Japan, and that leaves the door open for a repetition of some of that brutal history.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that, Jeremiah. We'll move on. This is Trumpet Hour, Trumpet Radio 101.3. Ever since Election Day on November 8th, the mayor of New York City has been pressing for last-minute executive actions from the White House before President Obama leaves office. Well, to see how he's rallying a number of big city mayors against the incoming president, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. This is a trend we've been watching pretty much ever since the election, is this kind of like the cultural divide in America between the cities and the big cities and the rest of the country. Even saying that some people saying that the big cities, obviously being Democratic Party strongholds, pretty much the rest of the country voting for Donald Trump. And then with a lot of political analysts pointing to that the ideological division between the two is greater than any time since the Civil War. And this is one trend that highlights that is the America's biggest city, New York City, its mayor, Bill de Blasio, has been putting together a coalition of other mayors, including from like Atlanta, Los Angeles, Chicago. I think there were 9 in all that had this conference call where they were really pushing for Barack Obama to renew his, you remember his famous executive order granting amnesty to illegal immigrants in the country. They're saying he needs to renew that early before he leaves office. That way Trump wouldn't, he'd have a very hard time undoing it until 2018. And they've also mentioned that there was, we've talked about this on this program before, that like a database that the George W. Bush administration had used to track non-immigrant visitors from countries that have a history of terrorism. He said they needed to close that down so Trump couldn't revive it or use it. And actually, Obama did take that suggestion from them, and he's already done that. But they have a couple quotes in this article from our Trumpet Weekly from de Blasio just saying that he said if we could get like 200 major cities together to stand against the Trump administration, he said, what type of power block would that be towards like thwarting his agenda? The New York Times article that we've quoted in there even links like uses the phrase a block of island nations, basically saying that all the big cities, it's almost like this archipelago of island nations with enough population behind it that if they can get some semblance of unity, possibly led by New York City, you could really do a lot of political gridlock put in place that way.
You've made mention of the fact that just contrasting today's political environment with that of the Civil War, that it was North versus South at that time, and this is more this sort of Swiss cheese or like this archipelago of opposition that you're talking about. So it's a much more dangerous type of division between these two sides in a sense.
Right, because in the Civil War, I mean, like Charleston, South Carolina, the people in there were just as Democrat as the people in the country. Mm-hmm. And same in the North, the country people and the city people were Republican. So you actually had this division between segments of the nation, which even though that was America's most deadly war, worst case scenario, it could have just split in half. Where something like with this, where you've got like you said, like this Swiss cheese of the big cities, it's like said, secession's really not an option. It either has to come to reconciliation or just like French Revolution style violence.
Right. Yeah, a house divided against itself cannot stand. Well, we appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly. That's our weekly news report where we pack all the stories that we can find the best news of the week into one single report. We'd be happy to give it to you for free every Friday in your email inbox. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines from this past week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Brent.
Tehran warned this week that any civilian or military aircraft straying into its territory would be shot down. As they began 5 days of exercises in southern Iran, these war games were codenamed Defenders of the Valiant Skies 7. And they were testing a lot of their recently acquired equipment, some of those S-300 long-range anti-aircraft missile defense systems that they just got from Russia, from the nuclear deal as well. Their brigadier general, He said this, he said, quote, "We are witnessing the presence of a number of trans-regional planes outside the air and sea borders of the country, but we emphasize that these planes should know their limits and know that we will take action in less than 1 second." So to these exercises likely have a couple of purposes. One, to test that equipment, and also to warn foreign nations such as Israel that that if they have a proposed future strike against their nuclear facilities, they'll be ready.
And now over to Jeremiah.
Well, in North Korea, the leader actually came out this week and banned Christmas. He said North Koreans should instead celebrate his grandmother on that day. But the spirit of the holiday seemed alive and well between Russia and China, with Moscow delivering 4 Su-35 fighter jets to the Chinese military on Christmas Day. These are the first 4 of what will be 24 of those really intrepid jets, and these jets will significantly bolster China's military strength in the South China Sea.
North Korea leader grandmother day.
That's right.
Okay, now over to Richard.
The German military released the final figures for missions that they'd flown against the Islamic State in 2016 on Thursday, and they'd flown almost 700. Now, to point out that that was with reconnaissance planes and tanker aircraft, so they didn't do any actual dropping bombs. But a poll conducted after the Christmas market attack showed that 53% of Germans would be in favor of Berlin expanding its operations in the fight of the Islamic State, which, if you know how reticent the German people traditionally are against those kind of missions, that's a fairly big development.
All right, now we'll go back to Brent.
Defense News reported on Wednesday that for at least the next month, there will be no United States carrier strike group operating in the Mediterranean and Persian Gulf. The Dwight D. Eisenhower carrier strike group, they headed out of there on December 26th back to the United States. But the relief ship and the relief carrier ship, the George H.W. Bush, is still sitting at port in the United States. Now, normally, U.S. carrier groups relieve each other as they leave a theater, often handing off these duties inside the Persian Gulf or the Arabian Sea. But now the Bush is nowhere to be seen. And this bad transition comes at a horrible time as we see Iran increasing its offensive actions both in the Persian Gulf and in the Red Sea. So they have about 1 month to 2 months before another American aircraft carrier gets into the region.
And we'll finish our lightning round with Andrew.
The National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund announced that there have been 64 police officers shot to death in the line of duty in 2016, assuming there won't be any more deaths today or tomorrow. That's a 56% increase over last year. And probably most alarmingly, they announced that 1 in 3 of those officers, about 20, were shot in ambush-style attacks for no other reason than they were police officers, which is almost like a 200% increase, over 200% increase over last year.
All right. Well, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'd be happy to give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly, our weekly news report. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you later.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Robert F. Kennedy. Only those who dare to fail greatly can ever achieve greatly. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world. We'll be right back.